And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Larry Householder ousted this week as Speaker of the House of Representatives. The move follows an indictment on federal bribery charges involving the Republican leader and others. So we start the weekly news review with Dayton Daily News reporter Laura Bischoff. She joins us on Zoom. Laura, thank you for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely, our pleasure. And we also have on the phone Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Jesse Balmer. Jesse, welcome back.
Thanks again.
Our pleasure to have you. Before we get into the Householder stuff, Laura, let's start with today's news that happened late this morning, and it involves that 10 p.m. rule imposed on bars by the governor. What happened today?
So the Liquor Control Commission met through an online meeting and voted 3-0 in favor of instituting this new emergency rule, which would bump last call to 10 p.m. for bars and restaurants across the state. And the takeaway for me is that it would last call would now finally align more closely with my usual bedtime.
That's true. For those of us who would like to go to bed a little earlier, we now have an excuse to leave early and not be criticized for it. I can appreciate that, Laura, certainly. This is probably not sitting well with bar owners.
No, that it didn't go over well at all. A lot of the testimony came from bartenders, bar owners, attorneys who represent liquor permit holders, who said that this is going to devastate the industry, which is already feeling the hurt from the coronavirus shutdown and from reopening with all kinds of restrictions.
We'll have to keep an eye on that. And it just came down this morning, so we'll continue to watch and we'll have to see how this goes. Obviously, this is in response to the COVID-19 pandemic and the increase in numbers that has taken place across Ohio. And it was something that Governor DeWine thinks will help alleviate that. But let's talk about Larry Householder, the former Speaker of the House of Representatives. And before I get to you, Jesse, I want to continue with Laura for just a moment. Can you set the scene for us for what happened in the House as members voted pretty overwhelmingly to remove Larry Householder as Speaker?
They called the session at 10 a.m. yesterday and started pretty promptly and got right down to business. They voted, I think it was unanimous. There were a few people that were missing.
It looks like 90-0, according to your story.
Yeah, it was 90 or 91. They left the roll open, so technically the vote could change. It could have changed until they adjourned last night. But anyway, it was overwhelming. They said, we're going to vacate the office of Speaker. Bada boom, bada bing, and then they took a long break, like a 6-hour break, and then they reconvened around 4-ish, and there was a lot of hurry up and wait, and then they reconvened, and the Democrats made a motion immediately to expel Householder from his legislative seat. So earlier in the morning, they removed him from his legislative leadership position, which just takes a simple majority of 50 votes. But expelling a member requires 2/3 majority, I think, under the Ohio Constitution. And they did a roll call vote and they tabled that motion. And the table motion passed like 53-38 or so.
So not enough.
Right. So it basically the Republican shutdown discussion of expelling Householder from his seat. Now later, Bob Kupp, who was named the new Speaker of the Ohio House, the 99th Speaker in Ohio history, he said that the Ohio Constitution only allows you to expel a member once, not twice. And Householder is on the ballot for the 72nd House District, and he's unopposed. So it's quite likely he'll get reelected in November. And if he has not been convicted of a felony, which is another way that you are automatically removed from your legislative seat, then if they use up their one removal now, they might not have the option to remove him in January if this case is still dragging on.
And let's just remind listeners, I know that if you've been reading any of the regional papers or listening to our show where we featured reporters and our own segments on this, it was just a week and a half ago that Larry Householder and four other men were charged with racketeering. And this has been characterized as possibly the biggest bribery scheme in Ohio history. Let's bring Jesse back in to further expand upon that, just as a refresher, the Cliff's Notes version of what exactly we're dealing with, because this thing isn't over.
Yeah, certainly. So it was actually just last Tuesday that Larry Householder and several other people connected to him were charged with racketeering. They were arrested. And basically the allegations are that various energy companies, most likely First Energy, spent a decent amount of money funneled through some dark money groups, one of which was called Generation Now, for basically three purposes. One was to get Larry Householder elected to the Ohio House of Representatives, putting him in leadership role in the House of Representatives. The second was to pass a $1.3 billion bailout for two nuclear plants in northern Ohio. And the third was to, once that law was signed, to block a referendum effort to put it before voters that could have stopped that bailout.
And Jesse, you had an interesting angle to this story because, as Laura noted, former House Speaker Larry Householder, who is still a state lawmaker, is on the ballot in November and unopposed. And you've got this story that opens with the line, "Without Speaker Larry Householder's fundraising operation, House Republicans find themselves in a disastrous financial spot heading into competitive fall races." What does that mean?
Well, essentially, what has been done in the past is there is one fundraising arm for House Republicans. Right now it's called HRCC, and that's where people put money who want to get Republicans elected to the Ohio House of Representatives. But in the case of Householder, a lot of the money was given directly to his personal fundraising campaign or to this 501c4 Generation Now. And so there are millions of dollars sitting in both of those funds, but the fund that is used to elect House Republicans had something like $380,000 in it. And for those uneducated like myself in running a statewide House Republican campaign, a pretty like heated race can cost $500,000. So $380,000 is certainly not enough to run those races in November against Democrats, especially in competitive seats. So they're in a financial crunch. The Ohio Republican Party has offered to kind of bail them out by offering them the use of one of their funds and kind of running campaigns through them. So as of yesterday, the new speaker hadn't decided whether to use that option, but just financially going into November, they're in a bit of a tough spot.
And we're talking with Jesse Baumert from the Cincinnati Inquirer and Laura Bischoff from the Dayton Daily News. And Laura, let's bring you back in. As the November election nears, August is often described as sort of the kickoff of the fall campaign season. How do lawmakers in Columbus see this playing out on the campaign trail?
Well, you know, the districts are so gerrymandered that, you know, it would be quite difficult for the Democrats to retake control of the House. The Republicans have 62 of 99 seats, but this is certainly an opportunity for the Democrats to win back some seats. And I think, you know, if they have the funding to get their message out, the Householder case certainly provides them with a lot of fodder. So it's going to be a really interesting election year between this and the coronavirus and the civil unrest over racial justice issues. It's probably one of the most interesting election years that we've seen in decades.
So I'm wondering if you've heard from any Democrats who are maybe kicking themselves for not at least having somebody on the ballot against Householder. You note that he's running unopposed, and if they're looking to flip a seat, suddenly this one just became increasingly flippable, it would seem.
Well, certainly when, you know, going into it, go ahead, Jesse.
Oh, sorry. There are actually a couple people who are now mounting write-in campaigns. Okay. Now, write-in campaigns are very difficult to achieve. One is a Republican and one is an independent. But as I'm sure Laura would point out as well, Larry Householder was very well funded. He is very well known in that district, which includes Perry County, Licking County, and Coshocton County, kind of just east of Columbus. So running someone against him would be an uphill battle, and frequently people don't try to do it.
Jesse, could you tell me a little bit about Nick Owens? He's from here in our neck of the woods, Southwest Ohio, Brown County. And he called the FBI on a fellow Republican, Larry Householder.
Correct. There are a few, there are a lot of kind of bad guys in this indictment, or at least alleged bad guys, but there are a few people who turn out looking all right. And Nick Owens is one of them. He was a candidate for a House seat in Brown and Claremont counties, and he's from Brown County. And he had a meeting with the speaker and a couple of aides, whereas when the speaker was kind of bragging about spending a lot of money in a Dayton area race, and some of that money was used by a dark money group to run an ad against a Democrat there that was just kind of wildly inaccurate and really tipped the scales in a very close race. So Householder was using this as an example of how he can spend big money in a race like Nick Owens's. Ultimately, Owens was not the person selected by Householder's team to be the kind of Householder candidate in 2020. He ran against another fellow, Alan Freeman, who did get the support of Householder, and a lot of dark money was spent in that race as well. So in March of 2020 of this year, he called up the FBI and said, you know, I think this smells fishy. So he's listed in one paragraph of that 81-page affidavit.
And again, we're talking with Jesse Balmer from the Cincinnati Inquirer and Laura Bischoff from the Dayton Daily News. And Laura, another very interesting story that you put out in this Householder saga. Citing sources, you report that he was looking to extend term limits. These were something that got in his way last time he was in the state house.
That's right. So he was quietly backing this term limit reform proposal that went to the ballot board on March 2nd. And it would reset the clock, put a lifetime cap of 16 years on lawmakers so that they couldn't bounce back and forth between the House and the Senate. Back in 1992, voters approved a constitutional amendment that limits lawmakers to eight consecutive years in either chamber. But there is a subset of lawmakers who kind of flip back and forth between the two chambers and have managed to stay on well beyond the eight-year limit. So this proposal would have, you know, could put the kibosh on that, but then it would also reset the clock so that anybody who's under this eight-year term limit now would be granted an extension to 16 years. So that would have positioned Householder to be speaker, I think, until like 2038, if he were able to hang on to power. And they had already started fundraising to put this on the ballot. Then, you know, the COVID outbreak kind of put the kibosh on signature gathering efforts, just making it inordinately difficult for anybody who needed to make the ballot.
And what happens now with House Bill 6, this nuclear plant piece of legislation at the center of this investigation, and now these federal charges that led to an indictment and ultimately the removal of the Ohio House Speaker? Jesse, is there any timeline on when this conversation may advance on the floor?
There are several different proposals on how to repeal and replace House Bill 6. In some regards, a simple piece of legislation because the goal was this bailout of the nuclear plants. But there are some moving parts, like they took away some incentives for energy efficiency and renewable energy. And so that could be complicated to undo. The other thing is the actual fee that's going to be on your electric bill, 85 cents for residential customers per month, is taking effect next year. So that seems to be one deadline to get some sort of repeal and replace done, but it doesn't necessarily have to be done this lame duck session, which is a session that happens after the election, but before lawmakers leave for the year. But I think there is some pressure to do something about it, but it is a complicated bill. So completely ripping it out of Ohio law is going to be challenging.
And Laura, your perspective on that?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Sure, absolutely. So I was just asking about, you know, the status of HB 6 and what might happen next, what you might be hearing about, what has the more likelihood to advance?
Yeah, I mean, they're going to do that. They've been talking repeal and replace. There's strong support for maintaining nuclear power. I don't see how they're going to structure this, given that the spinoff entity that used to be First Energy is the owner of these nuclear plants. Also, I do think that the bankruptcy court that heard the First Energy Solutions bankruptcy case has got to be wondering about bankruptcy fraud, given that there was $60 million undeclared in the bankruptcy proceedings that went through this Generation Now scheme, according to the FBI. And I would think also that the SEC is probably very interested in this case and what happened. That First Energy is a publicly held company. So I think there's going to be a lot of confusion around that company that owns those nuclear power plants for quite some time.
Well, you're both doing excellent reporting on this unfolding saga, and I really appreciate the time both of you took with us. I want to thank Dayton Daily News reporter Laura Bischoff and Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Jesse Balmer for being with us. Thanks to you both.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And just ahead, Kentucky grapples with a spike in COVID cases, and the governor implements new restrictions. And later, a decrease in driving during this pandemic has not resulted in a corresponding number of fewer deadly crashes. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. New restrictions in Kentucky are in effect as the state grapples with this spike in COVID cases. And the Commonwealth is also figuring out how November's election will take place. The weekly news review continues right now with Courier Journal reporter Joe Sonka. He's on the phone with us. Joe, welcome back.
Thanks, Michael.
And we also have on the phone Herald Leader reporter Daniel DeRochers. Daniel, welcome back to you as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Joe, during Governor Beshear's Thursday media briefing about the coronavirus, though the numbers are still comparatively high to where they were earlier in this thing, he seemed to express some optimism that perhaps we might be at a point where it's leveling off a bit, right?
Yeah, that's correct. The number of cases is still very high if you look all the way back to March when the pandemic started. But it has remained relatively flat over the past week. And Beshear says he's somewhat cautiously optimistic that the imposed mask mandate from a couple of weeks ago might finally be showing an effect in stopping the upward trajectory of cases, which we had seen in the preceding weeks starting in early July. So he's hoping that there was a delayed effect on that, and that might be leveling off of the number of cases before he would hope that it starts going down again.
Well, the governor's also emphasizing this number of cases involving children aged 5 and under. What's the underlying message to that? Why is that something that he seems to find important to note each day?
Yeah, that's, go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, Daniel, please, go ahead.
I'm only guessing it, right? I'm not in his head, but I think that, one, people are paying attention to that number, especially as we look at whether or not public schools and private schools can reopen for the fall. And I think that, you know, there's definitely this perception going around that, you know, this is a disease that only affects older people, and that's largely because of the death rate among older people, right? So if you look at Kentuckians who are older than 80, 20% of the Kentuckians older than 80 that have caught this disease have died from it. And then when you look at people, you know, at children, we tend to not see that same kind of death rate. You know, they tend to recover, bounce back from it. There's only been one child younger than 9 who's died from it, and it was kind of one of those, the child had it, but it wasn't necessarily the main reason that the child died. And so I think that he's, you know, especially when we were seeing this complacency that was causing the virus to spread further throughout the state, I think that it's his attempt to kind of check that complacency and to make sure that people are still aware that it can just spread in the community.
And we're talking with Joe Sanka from the Courier-Journal and Daniel DeRochers from the Herald-Leader. Joe, I believe it was your colleague, Joe Girth at the Courier-Journal, who wrote a column that something along the lines of, it's nice to see the old Bashir back. I think that was a reference to Bashir's performance in the earlier days of this pandemic. And then, of course, the numbers started to improve. The curve was flattened. And it seemed the community may have gotten lax with the reopening of parts of the economy. And now, I guess, the old Bashir's back. I'm curious. I know that's not your column, but both you and Daniel are observing the governor very closely during this period. Is that something you're seeing? Has he returned to the sort of sense of urgency that he had in the beginning?
Well, he has a little bit of cover. Dr. Brix from the White House obviously came in on Sunday. The day before he reclosed bars in Kentucky and reduced restaurant capacity again, who came into Kentucky and gave that recommendation the day before he went and did it. So he had a little backing to say that the White House is in support of this, too. It's not just me. But he has gone back to the daily briefings about the coronavirus that he had in the early days of March and April. In May, he stopped doing that and started going to a weekly briefing on that. But once the cases started going up again, he started doing that daily 4 p.m. briefing again. And now he's mandated masks. In the past week, he's gone back to the restaurants, back to 25% capacity. So it's kind of like we're back into the days of April and May again in terms of Bashir's a kind of daily focus on the pandemic.
And he is, of course, taking fire, the governor, from opponents and critics about some of these restrictions that are being reimposed and more heartily emphasized. But he's also taking some fire more recently, of course, about the handling of the unemployment situation in the state. We learned recently that an unemployment director who may have been characterized as not having the right qualifications to lead such a thing was ultimately fired, and now that person is very upset. And Daniel, I'm hoping that you can give us a brief overview of what that case is about.
Yeah, I mean, the state hired a guy named to run the unemployment office. Generally, people don't expect for there to be a massive pandemic that causes thousands of people to be unemployed. And I think that, you know, he was called in to give testimony in the House Interim Committee on Economic Development yesterday. Okay. And, you know, the big thing here is Chairman Russell Weber kind of started out the meeting by saying that it isn't political. But it is really political, right? When you're bringing in a fired staffer of the unemployment office to talk about why there have been difficult issues or why there have been challenges in the unemployment office, a lot of this is politics, right? Because we do have this situation in Kentucky where a lot of people are not getting their unemployment checks because it's really complicated. The system is kind of a mess, and there just haven't been enough staffers for enough period of time to really get everybody processed. Politically, it makes sense that the Republicans would try to jump on that and to expose kind of Bashir's weakness in that way. It was really interesting to me because, you know, this guy gave his testimony, and if you looked at the different outlets across the state, I think all, you know, many of the outlets came away with different things from what he said, right? So where I was focused on the fact that he talked about the data breach, the unemployment data breach that we had here in April had existed before before anybody did anything about it. I think Joe had a different takeaway. And it's one of those where it's like, it was obviously important that this guy was testifying, but it was hard to get a clear message on exactly what the issues are, because it seems like there are just so many issues with the unemployment system overall, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. And Joe, would you like to expand on that?
Yeah. And in going back to Daniel's point about this being political, by the end of the committee, the committee meeting is certainly what Democrats were saying was political, because it was kind of rare that the only people really getting questions in the committee meeting were the Republicans. Like, over a dozen Republicans were able to ask questions and repeatedly, and there was only one Democrat who got a question in when all the other Democrats were trying to. So Democrats certainly complained about that and said that this was kind of a political theater to hit Bashir. But there were a lot of important issues discussed in the over hour long meeting. Daniel mentioned the data breach that was actually McNamara was aware of it the day before that the rest of the cabinet was aware of it. And there's also questions. McNamara said that the Bashir administration just moved way too fast in trying to get contract workers and independent workers to apply for unemployment benefits when the computer system had no way to process those claims. So that just led to more and more of the backlog and claims getting denied. So there was a lot of information, and I'm sure we probably haven't heard the last of Mr. McNamara and what he's saying up there.
Well, Joe, what is the status of the state and Governor Bashir's administration's attempts to rectify as much of the unemployment situation as they can? We know, like, in recent weeks, they had opened up some regional offices. A lot of those appointment times filled up immediately. What have we learned, if anything, in recent days that the administration is doing in an effort to alleviate some of these folks' economic suffering?
Well, the big strategy this week is, or in the coming week, is that they're going to have in-person services in Louisville, obviously the biggest city in Kentucky. So they announced that this week, and they set up appointments for people to come in and resolve their claims in Louisville. And I think it was only like 5 hours or so that all of those appointments got taken up, and the website was even down for some of that time. So I think what we've shown is that if the Bashir administration announces that they're going to have in-person services anywhere in the state, it's immediately swallowed up. There's such a demand for this, and there's so many people that really need help processing their claims that haven't been able to speak to an actual human being besides the robocalls that some of these people waiting for on claims get that just says, hey, we haven't forgotten about you, and then it hangs up on you. So that seems to be the priority in the next week going ahead, is to get as many people settled in Louisville as possible.
And we're talking with Joe Sonka from the Courier-Journal in Louisville and Daniel DeRogers from the Herald-Leader in Lexington. I enjoy both of your reporting so much, but particularly during election season. And rather than dissecting a race, we'll have the opportunity to do that in a future show, I hope. But let's talk more broadly about the election in general. Daniel, we don't know yet exactly how we might be voting in Kentucky yet?
Pretty much, yeah. Secretary of State Michael Adams has been really reluctant to commit to doing no-excuse absentee voting like we did in the primary. Part of this, actually a lot of this, is just purely on principle. So I asked him about this after the primary, and he just basically baldly said, you know, I won the election, I shouldn't have to impose the campaign promises of my opponent that I beat. And so he just kind of flatly does not like the idea of no excuse absentee voting. But there's also questions of volume, right? So in a primary, you tend to see lower turnout. And we saw, you know, a massive amount of ballots came in by mail. There was a lot that went through there. And, you know, just kind of learning the process as it went along. Well, turnout's usually way higher in a general election, and especially in a general election with a presidential election. And so Adams has expressed kind of concern over the volume of ballots that would be coming through the mail and whether county clerks would be equipped to process those. There's also talk of increasing the number of in-person voting locations, right? So in most counties, there was only one in-person voting location. And in Fayette County, that ended up in lines that, you know, it took like 2 hours to go vote. And so they want to expand the amount of in-person polling locations. But a lot of that relies on poll workers. And poll workers tend to be older, the type of people who are more vulnerable to this virus. And so there's also this kind of effort to get poll workers recruited that are younger. But I mean, yeah, basically right now we don't know what this is going to look like. And with the clock ticking, especially if they have to get the absentee mail-in votes set up, you know, they need to come up with some kind of solution relatively quickly.
Joe, we saw this amazing turnout in the primary, and we had the president of the United States just yesterday calling into question either the integrity or the ethics or even the technical delivery of the process through which so many of those ballots were cast in Kentucky. Did we hear from Secretary Adams on the president's suspicion that widespread voter fraud will take place if more Americans are voting by mail in November due to the pandemic?
Well, Michael Adams says that he wants to make it easier to vote and harder to cheat. That's kind of his campaign slogan, and he's kept it through as Secretary of State. It's clear that Michael Adams is very proud of the way Kentucky handled its primary election. He says that, you know, we had a record number of voters voting and during a pandemic, and he said that there's no evidence of any massive fraud from the primary. He hasn't really commented at all on, Trump's suggestion that you delay the general election or that it's going to lead to massive fraud. You did see Senator Mitch McConnell kind of politely say that it's going to be on November 3rd, and we've gone through civil wars and depressions in the past, and it hasn't changed the date of the general election. You do see Michael Adams is hesitant to go with the no-excuse absentee voting by mail. Again, this fall, Governor Beshear did say this week that he does want it to be no-excuse mail-in yet again because the pandemic is even worse now than it was back in June when we had the primary election. And as Daniel said, we kind of have to act fast here, and it has to be Beshear and Adams have to be on the same page to make an executive order. If they're not on the same page, then we just go back to the way elections were done last year, where you have to have be impaired because of age or impaired because of illness to cast an absentee ballot or to even vote early in person. One thing Michael Adams did say that he wants to keep in-person early voting and even expand that to Saturdays, which we didn't have in the primary. So Beshear and Adams still need to come to some kind of agreement, or it's just going to be the way it was in the past in Kentucky elections during a pandemic, which could be very dicey.
We're talking with Joe Sonka from the Courier-Journal and Daniel DeRochers from the Herald Leader. Daniel, you noted just moments ago that the clock is ticking on such a decision. Is there any indication about how far in advance they really need to set this in stone so that the county clerks can prepare, so that voters can be educated? This is more than just making a simple decision and flipping a switch.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that there's any deadline. It's mostly just as soon as possible, right? The more time the county clerks have to prepare, the more time that they can get information out to the public, the better off you're going to be. I think that, you know, we do have an innate advantage in that the primary worked this way, right? Like, we're not flipping the switch from a normal non-pandemic election to a pandemic election. We've already done one election in a pandemic. But it is just one of those where you got to act quickly, because this is one of those things that is really, really, really important. And, you know, ideally they'll come to an agreement. I just don't know what their timeline looks like for making this decision. After the primary, Secretary of State Adams seemed to indicate that it would happen in August. And so I think that, you know, we'll probably see an announcement coming within this month. It's just a matter of when and whether or not these two people who are pretty diametrically opposed in many ways and how they see this election going can sit down at a table and agree.
Well, I don't see any shortage of things for us to talk about again soon. I hope to have you both back in order to do that. Joe Sonka from the Courier-Journal, Daniel DeRochers from the Herald Leader. Always love having you both on. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks, and we continue the weekly news review now with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Hannah Sparling, who's on the phone. Hannah, thank you for coming back on.
Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure to have you back. Listen, a really interesting story you put together. Of course, we know we're driving less this year due to COVID-19, but we're still dying in car crashes as often as before?
Yeah, so it was a really, really sad thing to find out. I've been looking kind of at traffic and crash rates since this all started, and obviously, like you said, everything kind of plummeted. People were staying home, not going to work, and just not going out. But when you looked at crash rates across the state, they were down kind of about 20% overall, a little more in some places, a little less in others. But then when I looked at fatals, they were actually up this year compared to last year. So that means, you know, fewer crashes overall, but those that are happening are just much more serious.
So I know this is probably a difficult question for anyone to answer, but why?
Yeah, I think I'm sure there's a lot that plays into it, but I do think that the main factor is just speed. And I think it's because there are fewer cars on the road to slow each other down. You know, when there's a lot of traffic, you drive slower. So if you bump into someone and you're going 20 miles an hour, you know, you both might be okay. But if you're going a lot faster than that, you might not be. And the Highway Patrol has handed out a lot more tickets for people going over 100 miles per hour. So people are definitely speeding more.
And you cite a study in your report from Ohio State University that says in Ohio's three major cities, we're talking about Cincinnati, Columbus, and Cleveland, drivers are apparently taking advantage of empty roads to drive faster, making streets and highways potentially more dangerous. So what are traffic enforcement officers saying about this? Or are they not patrolling as much because there has been fewer cars on the road?
Yeah, I think the Highway Patrol wanted to make that really clear. They think there's kind of people have a perception they're not out there handing out tickets as much, but they wanted to send the message that they are out there, they will ticket you, and just kind of pleading with people to follow the speed limit and slow down.
I know you talked to Derek Bowman of Vision Zero. We've had him on the program multiple times to talk about this pedestrian safety issue in the city of Cincinnati. And talk a little bit about what he had to say about this. I know he's not one to hold back on opinions on this.
Sure. Yeah, so he and others have said the same thing as well, that basically the problem is just the design of our streets, that they're designed to turn pretty much any road, whether that's an actual highway or something going right through a neighborhood, into a highway-like street. And so if you remove traffic, like this happened during the pandemic, people just kind of fly down those streets. So his suggestion is to put what he calls traffic calming measures in, so that's making streets narrower, maybe adding things like bike lanes, more space for pedestrians, lower speed limits, speed bumps, just things to kind of slow drivers down and sort of force you to pay attention so you can't zone out and just go as fast as you can.
And just for more local analysis from Hannah's reporting here, Hamilton County had 28 fatal crashes this year. That's one more than during the same time frame in 2019. Of course, you can read this story at the Cincinnati Enquirer online. We're talking with Hannah Sparling from the Cincinnati Enquirer. Very strange story, but a sign of the times, of course, that you also covered this week involving mask policy and metro buses. Can you tell us how angry one certain passenger got?
Sure. And these are, you know, we've kind of heard these from around the world, but this is the first I'd heard of locally. So masks have been mandatory on Metro ever since the governor's statewide order took effect. And there was this past week one customer who just got so angry when he was asked to put on a mask that he pulled a knife and threatened the driver. And so no one ended up getting injured. I think he just left ultimately. But it just, I mean, it's scary that something like that would happen.
No kidding. And the thing is that the Metro drivers are on the front lines of this. They are still encountering mm-hmm. a lot of people who are riding the buses. And there are, of course, restrictions in place to try to assist them in combating the spread of COVID-19. But what do we have, 10 drivers now so far who have tested positive?
Yeah, I think it was 10 as of yesterday. And that's 10 drivers who have been driving during the pandemic. There were two others who tested positive, but they haven't been working. So, but 10 who have been driving routes, kind of interacting with the public, have tested positive so far.
Can you tell us a little bit about what Metro has done, what they've put in place in order to help the drivers and protect the passengers and the drivers?
At Metro, they've done a fair amount. I mean, there's a shield kind of trying to separate the driver from the passengers. They're asking people whenever they can to pay using the app so they're just touching less and interacting less. And then the masks are another thing. And they've also implemented a lot more cleaning. The buses are sanitized, I think, every night. And it's with a special spray that's supposed to kill the virus. So they're stepping up a lot. And they do remind people of that every time they send out a release to notify about another driver testing positive.
Well, tell us what they do when they find out that a driver tests positive. I guess there's no way to call all the passengers, but that's probably something they want people to know.
Yeah, so they issue a news release every time, and I think it's the exact same release every time. It just says a bus driver has tested positive. I didn't name the driver or anything, but it says this is the last time the bus driver worked, and these are the routes he or she drove. So it just asks people that if they were on the bus on one of those routes, that they should kind of monitor themselves for symptoms, maybe get tested if they think they need to, just kind of letting anyone who might have come into contact with that driver know, hey, this person's tested positive.
And we're talking with Hannah Sparling from the Cincinnati Enquirer. And Hannah, but before I let you go, let's touch on some good news. You got to write about a cute story on social media, CVG Airport. Definitely got some traction from this thing. It was a little stuffed puppy that they named Jet. And I'm sure some of our listeners may have seen this circulating on Facebook and Twitter. Tell us about Jet. It ends up with a pretty happy ending.
Yeah, finally some good news in 2020, right? But it was a little stuffed puppy that someone had left behind at the airport. And the airport posted on Twitter, you know, trying to figure out who it was. Sort of the puppy kind of doing different things around the airport, you know, visited a canine officer at the airport, things like that. And then they finally were able to find the little boy whose puppy it was, and then they flew the puppy home to him in Florida. So that was nice. I think a lot of people saw that. We're just really hoping for just something good to happen for once.
And now the social media team has to come up with something else out there. So that's a challenge.
Yeah, but I don't know. That's a challenge for them, but the rest of us are happy.
Indeed. Hannah Sparling from the Cincinnati Inquirer, thank you so much for taking some time with us today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
And now we're joined right here in a socially distanced dual neighboring studio by WVXU reporter and host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhardt. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Okay. I want to know more about this new feature. We featured this a couple of weeks ago. You can hear it on occasion on Wednesdays, I believe. We hear, okay, I want to know this new feature that you developed, and we're going to play the new installment of that very fun series here. If you follow Bill at all on social media, you know that he is a wanderer of the Central Business District downtown and along the river, and he's always stumbling upon interesting things to share with those of us who dutifully like and retweet his Ohio River Report each day. And which, by the way, Bill,
yes,
what is today's Ohio River Report?
It came around 7 o'clock this morning. Did you not see it?
I saw it. I like it.
It was on Twitter.
Every day, Bill Reinhardt stands in the same place.
Most days.
And
most
takes days. A picture of the Ohio River, and that is the Ohio River Report. And that's all there is to it, and it's a lovely, darling feature. And I have another darling feature. And for those who have not come into contact yet with OK, I Want to Know, we've seen you dive into President Taft, why he doesn't have a presidential statue,
yes,
in the city.
Yes.
And second installment included a story about who plays the organ at Great American Ballpark,
yes,
which,
yes,
is finally relevant again because we get to see action at GABP,
or
at least
listen
virtually.
To it. Yeah,
yeah, certainly. So that was fun. Can you tell us a little bit about that one? Because that one's in between the one that we're going to play now and the one that we played earlier. So they can find that at WVXU.org.
Well, John Schutte is the organist. He's also the keyboard player for the Rusty Griswolds. You may have seen them in concert somewhere around the area. And he's been playing the organ at Great American Ballpark for, what, 10 years now? Just kind of stumbled on it by accident. He was talking to the club about a post-game concert, and he said, hey, who do you have playing the organ? And they said, do you want to do it? Show up this Sunday. And he's been doing it ever since, and he takes requests. You can get a hold of him on Twitter when he will be playing. He's not playing for the team now. They're not letting him back into the ballpark just yet. A lot of people, you know, can't get in, and he's one of them. But maybe later in the season or maybe next season, he'll play your request, possibly. I clued him into a song that he checked out, and he says, yeah, you know what? That's going to work out well. I think I'll use that.
It's going to work out well.
Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting.
It's the Los Straight Jackets cover of the song from Titanic. Yeah.
That's a Bill Reinhardt request if I ever heard one.
So he's covering a cover.
As a man about downtown, what are you seeing downtown during Reds games now? I mean,
it's quiet.
Yeah.
It's been quiet this week. It's been quieter this week. I mean, ever since things started reopening, you know, there was a gradual rise in activity downtown. And just the last couple of nights, I've noticed things have been quieter, and not just because of the weather. Wednesday night, you know, it was a perfect night. There was nobody out downtown.
You know, on the opening day, the so-called opening day, which was,
last
I guess,
Friday.
Just last Friday, I took a long walk from Covington into the Central Business District and back, and I did see a pretty well hopping, you know.
Yeah.
I saw a lot of people
Friday
there.
Last Friday seemed to be a little busier, but
yeah.
The last couple of nights have been strangely quiet.
Well, I don't mean to babble on. I mean, I just want to note that, you know, you are a man about town, and you do take some walks, and that's relevant to the next piece we're going to play. But before we dive into this very interesting story that could only come from your mind, and OKI is this feature.
We should probably explain the name. OKI Want to Know. The O stands for Ohio, K for Kentucky, I Indiana. OKI Want to Know.
Because we had a staff meeting where this was confusing even internally.
We had a lengthy meeting, and that was the best name we could come up with.
Shall be.
It could have been an email.
Shall remain nameless. But
this is where you find unique stuff, right? That may be weighing on people's minds, but they're afraid to ask. And this is something that you're not afraid to ask. So give us an overview of what people should submit. Is it really just anything?
Well, for instance, this one we're going to play here in a minute. I've lived downtown for 12 years, and probably 10 years ago, I'm walking along and I'm not listening to music at the time, but I hear something, just this. It's like, what is that? Where's that coming from? And I trace the sound back to this black box, this black triangular box on top of a street pole. Like, what could possibly be in there? And it's one of those things like, you know, I'm really curious about this, but it's not a big deal. I mean, there's bigger things I have to work on. I got to cover, you know, city council or the county commission or this or that. I got to go to a shooting or whatever. And it's just one of those things that's like, this is really gnawing at me, but I don't have time to professionally run it down. Well, now I do. Now I do. All those little things I've been wondering about, I've got an excuse to run them down. And fortunately, if I run out of stuff, which I'm kind of getting there, a lot of people have questions along the same lines.
Are there any themes emerging from what people are submitting? I know you like to be secretive about what might be coming up. So, but I mean, are you seeing any themes emerge?
Yes. Yes, I am.
No further hints?
There's a garage door near a railroad overpass. It's, someone wants to know what's in there. There's a lot of questions about street names. Where do street names come from? And that's going to be, I think we're going to get into that a lot if this continues beyond the next 4 weeks, if they don't just cut me off.
They're not going to cut you off, Bill. We love you too much for that. All right. Bill Reinhart, thank you for coming in and being with us. We're going to play this OK, I Want to Know segment. Josh, go ahead and roll it.
Picture a downtown sidewalk. There's a few trees, a fire hydrant, parking meters, and a few poles with maybe a triangular black box on top. That box might just have a parking sign on it. You might also hear a noise coming from inside. It doesn't happen often, and it's not very loud. But there is a distinct mechanical electrical whirring noise from inside the box. I've heard it at night and in the daytime, but with no regularity and without any apparent rhyme or reason. Is it a giant automatic air freshener? Are time-traveling aliens adding mind-control drugs to the atmosphere? Are they chemical markers for the lizard people?
So what's in the box?
John Brozina is Director of Transportation and Engineering for the City of Cincinnati, and he has the answer.
That is actually an electrical panel for our streetlights.
That simple?
It's that simple.
So what do they do?
You know, we have streetlights all throughout the Cincinnati Business District. Those panels that you see, there's about 15 to 20 of them across the CBD, and they just kind of help us manage the streetlight circuits.
Okay, so why was that one making a noise? Brozina says he doesn't know specifically why that one was drawing attention to itself, but there may have been a problem with a circuit. He says when there is an issue, crews go out to fix it.
Those are actually designed to have a little easier access and to be concealed. So we have those, and we have some in pull boxes in the ground, and some of them we actually have just like in silver boxes on the poles itself.
It's a generational thing. Every new technology to control streetlights comes in a different shape and gets put in a different place. So that's it. Mystery solved. There's no grand conspiracy here, except Brozina almost forgot what might be the best part of the story.
We actually call them cheeseheads. On top of the poles, because they actually look like a wedge of cheese. So when we talk about it internally, we talk about the cheese head on the pole.
Got a question about the area? Share it with us, and we'll see what we can find. Just go to wvxu.org/OKI. Bill Reinhart, 91.7 WVXU.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at wvxu.org. I'm Michael Monks.